Thank you. Be seated. In Orange Carding Fiberglass versus the Honorable Neil Caldwell, the court has allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The court is ready to hear oral argument from relator.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. With the court's leave, I would like to indicate at the outset how I would hope to proceed this morning. If I might, I would like to begin with what I think are two extremely serious problems for the adversary system that the district court's departures from settled law would create. And then I would like to turn to what I think are two very fundamental fallacies. Fallacies in the plaintiff's theory about how attorney-client privilege and work product protection are being invoked as laundering devices, essentially to cover up relevant and discoverable material, and fallacies in the plaintiff's theory about how alleged gaps in the record before this court might prevent it from granting effective relief. Now, as to the problems that I think are posed before this court, I think it's terribly important to recognize that they are not simply problems for asbestos defendants. In the litigation-intensive world that we have become used to, a great many people and institutions can protect their rights only through repetitive litigation of the same legal issues going to court over and over again. Now, usually, that is true for people on the defendant's side, but as I will indicate, it's not limited to defendants. In hazardous product suits against manufacturers like OCF, of course, the problem arises, but it arises in such suits against schools that are said to have too much lead paint, against hospitals whose procedures are said to expose patients to undue danger. It's true in defamation suits, which are often repetitive against newspapers and TV stations for a particular series of acts, deprogramming suits against evangelical churches, deportation suits against church sanctuaries, trespass suits against activist groups like Operation Rescue, which finds itself in court quite frequently, even repeated prosecutions, criminal prosecutions, of some hardy individuals like that couple up in New Hampshire that kept covering up live free or die on their license plate. And the state, without any sense of irony, kept prosecuting them for it. And finally, the U.S. Supreme Court had to say in Woolley v. Maynard that they had a right to cover up that license plate. But they found themselves in court over and over again. I also want to stress that sometimes plaintiffs find themselves in this situation. Civil rights organizations like the NAACP Legal Defense Fund had to engage in a rather long history of repetitive litigation to help desegregate the schools. And in school educational finance cases of the sort with which this court is intimately familiar, very often organizations have had to keep going to court. Now, there's nothing terribly remarkable about that. That's what is often understood by the litigation explosion. But the point I want to make about it is this. In order to cope with that problem, a litigant has got to do something better than reinventing the wheel in each case. It's rather obvious what has to be done in order to effectively vindicate one's rights without being exhausted in the process. One obviously has to get legal help to design an overall legal strategy. That includes postmortems on trials that are done, maintaining elaborate files on the sorts of materials that were used in those trials, developing a whole strategy, and very often that work product has nothing to do with any particular case. It is of the essence of the modern litigious situation that if you viewed each case as an isolated package, the situation of the repeat litigant would be dismal indeed. Now, the problem that I have in mind, indeed, I think it's not too much to call it a disaster, a crisis, if the approach of the district court in this case were to prevail, is that your opponent in any of these situations, either the plaintiff in many of the cases where it's the defendant that keeps getting dragged into court, or the defendant in the situation where the plaintiff has to keep going to court, under the approach of the district court, your opponent could discover the entire work product of your legal team, both in-house and out of house, from all of the prior cases, those that are still pending, those that are done, those that have been settled, and the massive work product, which is not claim-specific or case-specific, but which is generated by the desire to cope with this burgeoning problem of repeat litigation. Because under the view that was clearly and explicitly taken by the district court to justify its wholesale rejection of the work product claim, what happens is that everything not prepared for the instant case is not protected by work product. Now, what's extraordinary about that, it seems to me, is that if that were what the rules said, one might still wonder why they weren't being bent a bit in order to avoid the crisis. But the rules don't say that. That is, there is literally no support in the text, the rule 166B3A, the work product rule, for this novel claim-specific theory.
Let's assume you're 100% correct about that. The district court's wrong on that, and the one El Paso Court of Appeals on the subject is in error also. There were some other grounds cited by the district court on this matter, and of course, neither work product nor attorney-client privilege are absolute. They can be waived. And
well, that's right, Your Honor, and it seems to me that waiver is perhaps the most important other ground, and I would be glad to turn to that. If I might just add a word about where the district court seems to have gotten its theory as a work product, I think it simply misread Allen v. Humphreys, which is a decision clearly limited to 166B, 3, C, and D, witness statements and party communications. There's no basis for that one apparent Court of Appeals decision. Justices Brennan and Blackmun, in their concurring opinion in Grolier, pointed out how the whole purpose of the work product doctrine would be gravely eroded if it were made claim-specific. And it seems to me there's simply no authority for it. But as you point out, Justice Doggett, there were other grounds, and the most important among them was the theory of waiver. That is the fundamental theory, and it's a very sweeping one, and it leads to what I would regard as the second crisis for the adversary system that follows from the approach of the district court. The theory really is, in broad form, that if you deny what you're accused of, you then expose yourself to discovery of all attorney-client communications bearing on the denial. I mean, in particular, the theory seems to be this, that if you are in the unlucky position of being one of those people or institutions or companies that's accused of knowing or deliberate or reckless conduct, that happens to companies that are said either actually or constructively to know of some dangers, but it also happens to newspapers in defamation cases, it happens to defendants in criminal cases all the time where intent is typically involved. If you have the temerity to say, but I deny it, I didn't know, I want to invoke my rights under the open courts provision and the due course provision of the Texas Constitution. I want to invoke my rights under the First Amendment to petition the government. I want to invoke my rights under the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. All I'm doing is denying your claim. And, of course, the plaintiffs in this case admit that they have the burden of production and persuasion on this issue of whether OCS knew or should have known. At that point, the remarkable thing is that that is said to be an offensive use, kind of state-of-the-art defense, if you will. If you look at the tenth finding, and it's really the most important in many ways, of the district court in its order of October 18th, this court finds that by concealing certain documents, I'm reading from page 3 of appendix A30, and I know the court is so loaded down with materials and appendices here that I think it would be understandable if it wasn't right at your fingertips, but it's pretty short. It says, this court finds that by concealing certain documents related to its knowledge of prior claims and its knowledge of the harms of exposure to fibers, while asserting a state-of-the-art defense, i.e., we didn't know, nor should we have known, we're denying your claim, the defendant has attempted to make an offensive use of rules governing privilege. That's a waiver, says the court. And they treat that as a waiver, really, of everything. Now, I guess I understand where the court got the idea. That is, it read Justice Gonzalez-Ginsburg opinion, and it said, or at least I don't know that the court read it because it acted so quickly in approving the report of the special master less than 2 days after we filed our objections, that I suppose one could say that it simply rubber-stamped it, which itself is something of an abuse of discretion. But in any event, what the court says, it seems to say, what the special master obviously believed, was that Ginsburg controls. Well, I think that it's pretty clear that the unanimous opinion in Ginsburg provides no support for that sweeping theory of waiver. There, I'm sure the court will recall that a plaintiff sued for trespass and herself injected the fact that she had sought the help of a psychiatrist. She affirmatively chose to inject that issue. The court said she sought affirmative relief. That was one of her ways of explaining away a deed that she couldn't recall signing. But if she signed it, her trespass claim would have fallen apart. Well, she was really trying to have her cake and eat it too. But if she was trying to say, I saw a psychiatrist. Oh, and then what happened? Oh, I won't tell you. Well, that's obviously very different. That is a classic instance of waiver by offensive use. It's like the defendant who's prosecuted for income tax evasion. You knowingly violated your duty under the tax laws. And the defendant says, no. In fact, my lawyer told me that this was just fine, that I did not owe any taxes. Well, you put that affirmatively in issue. You refer to the thing. Then it stands to reason that you can be required then to expose it. That's always been the law with respect to the psychiatrist consultation area. Though there is some authority for saying that the attorney-client privilege in its codification here does not have a similar exception. I'd be willing to assume that it did in extreme cases, but surely it cannot be said that OCF affirmatively is exploiting the communications with the legal department, in-house counsel, and outside counsel simply by invoking its state and federal constitutional rights to deny liability. But I do think I understand, though I must admit it took me quite a while, I do think I understand how the district court and the special master really came to that conclusion. That is how it is. I don't think an ad hominem explanation will do. I mean, one could talk about the relative inexperience of the special master, the rapidity with which the court just rubber stamped the findings. That's unsettling. But you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that what this district court did is not exactly a statement of Anglo-American law in any jurisdiction. My students at Evidence, I think, would have seen through that. I think that what was going on was something quite different. And that's what I refer to when I describe the fallacy that I think led to this result.
Counsel, I have several quick questions for you.
Sure, Justice Cook.
Didn't your client have a responsibility to place indefinitely with the trial court the documents that they're claiming that are privileged?
Your Honor, no. I think the fact is that because my client was specifically told by the special master on May the 7th, 1990, it's in Appendix A26, that it should not do that, and it followed her instruction that it didn't have that obligation. Let me just read to you quickly what she said. This is from page 237 of A26. I don't want responsibility for the documents overnight, so just let them, referring to a counsel for OCF, take the documents with them, the master. I think these fine ladies from Virginia, referring to the lawyers and paralegals from Wright Robinson, are very particular with their documents. I'm going to trust them explicitly to take care of them. I don't think there's any problem with that. This court, I think, did assume that the trial court, as would be the case if it had taken real responsibility over this case, had custody of the documents when on January...
When was that, Mr. Hunt?
Pardon?
When was that?
Well, the date what I just read, May 7th.
Well, on December 5th, wasn't the special master still complaining to your clients that they had not produced the documents?
Mr. Manning was in the courtroom at that time, and the special master on that December date made reference to an earlier court order. But there hadn't been any such order, and I think Mr. Manning may have been confused. But at no point did the trial court, which this court directed on January 23rd to turn the to submit the documents, at no point did it say, I can't comply, we don't have them. That is, I think this whole thing is a red herring. Under Pope v. Stevenson, it was the obligation of OCF to get the documents here. We've done that.
Well, let me ask you about getting the documents here. How is it that you got us, what, 16 boxes and you got the trial court 4 boxes?
Well, I think I have tried to study the difference between, there are big boxes and little boxes, and no one alleges that the repackaging, well, I mean, as I think you will hear, Mr. Ballard may allege that nothing that we do is reliable, but there is no evidence, no reason to believe that any of the repackaging reflects anything other than simply the way you handle 11,000 pieces of paper.
So you're saying we have nothing that is different from what the trial court
exactly.
did, except different size boxes.
You have different size boxes. You've got the documents. If there is any doubt about the documents, a special master who would be appointed if one were needed to look into the matter could deal with it.
As far as how you characterize Mr. Ballard's anticipated comments, the trial court and the master seem to have accepted the fact that your client did everything possible it could to avoid the discovery process and to defeat the trial court's attempt to get discovery in the spirit of our rule.
Right, and that is the fallacy that I want to talk about, Justice Duggan.
Well, let me ask you if it's true.
No.
Okay. Thank you. If that's true, isn't there justification for this court denying mandamus relief on the basis of the unclean hands doctrine?
I think if this court found in anticipation of what the Court of Appeals is going to hear a week from today, that we were guilty of all those things, then there may be some room for a clean hands exception.
So wouldn't the better practice be for us to hold ruling on this until the Houston Court of Appeals has ruled on the sanctions case and it's up here before us?
I'm afraid that there may be an Alphonse Gaston problem. That is, I detect some interest on their part in knowing whether the underlying misconduct of which we were accused, which essentially is insisting on our rights, is, in the view of this court, misconduct or simply an invocation of our rights. That is, it's a little funny for them to be accepting the claim or passing on the claim until it knows whether this court agrees with the submission we've made that the privileges were not waived, that the work product doctrine is not claim specific. The reason I think that they regard it as misconduct, I mean, there's a lot of rhetoric here. You're hiding, you're covering up, is because they have forgotten what the U.S. Supreme Court a decade ago unanimously said in Upjohn. It's a very fundamental point about the way these privileges operate that any piece of relevant and discoverable information that the plaintiffs could have gotten if we had never sought legal advice, legal help, by an appropriate request, they can still get it. Indeed, we've turned over these things, except when they insist on asking for them, as attachments to legal memoranda that expose our strategy or as part of compilations, as the AMA article that we refer to in the reply brief indicates. That's why it is a fundamental fallacy to suppose that somehow these privileges are a kind of obstruction of justice. What they want is for us to be worse off by virtue of having invoked our right to interpose a defense and to seek legal help. But they are not any worse off than they would be if we'd never heard of any lawyers. If indeed all the lawyers in the world, as some people I think wouldn't mind seeing, were to disappear from the face of the earth. Because in that event, they asked for a certain document in an appropriate way and it was relevant and discoverable, they'd get it. They seem to think that by virtue of communicating the information to a lawyer, or by virtue of a lawyer having compiled it together with something else, we launder the information. We put it in a kind of legal black hole so they no longer can get it. There is no basis in the world for thinking that the attorney-client privilege or the work product doctrine have that potential. And if they have that potential, there's no evidence that that's the way they were used here. That is, they asked for tens of thousands of documents. We produced over 37,000. As to the 11,000 that we said were privileged, there are some attachments to them, which if requested in some other way, it's obvious they would get. What they want to know is what we think is legally significant, and what in reflection of our situation over the years in trying to cope with our dilemma as a repeat litigant, what we have concluded about matters of legal strategy. And that is precisely what, under this court's decisions, and under the decisions in every jurisdiction in this country, and under the language of 166(3)(b)(3)(a), which is not the same as B, 3, C, and D, which are the ones they keep confusing it with in Allen v. Humphreys.
Do you think Allen v. Humphreys is fundamentally wrong, too?
Well, I think Allen v. Humphreys
is reflects... wrong there, or can you make a...
I can make a case for it, it seems to me. The puzzle that the court dealt with in Allen v. Humphreys is that you've got to draw some line between ordinary documents that are raised in the course of business and things that are really litigation-related. And when it's not attorney work product, but party communication or insurance adjuster investigation, in order to draw that line, it may make some sense, as the rules specifically do in codifying Allen v. Humphreys in 1984. Makes some sense to limit it in a claim-specific way, but there's certainly a lot of literature out there suggesting that it would be a more rational system if Allen v. Humphreys were cut back. But that isn't the issue before this court. The issue isn't should it be cut back. The issue is should it be exploded in such a way that the litigation explosion makes life impossible for plaintiffs and defendants who are in the dilemma of being repeat litigants.
Can waiver ever result from egregious discovery abuse?
Well, I see no authority in Rules 215 or 13 for that particular penalty in the rules. That is, there are a panoply of penalties that are authorized for discovery abuse. But I think there was no discovery abuse here. If there had been, and the reason our opponents seem to think there was, it's that they seem to think that the very invocation of these privileges is abusive. That is, the gist of their argument, the most recent submission in this court, is how dare these people not turn over everything? They're trying to hide the truth.
I'm referring to things like renumbering and switching documents, losing documents, filing misleading indices, making misrepresentations to the master and opposing counsel, the kind of things that were in the report the trial court adopted.
That's right. Justice Stockett, I have spent more time than I had intended to or cared to going over in detail the record before the special master. I think there is literally not a scintilla of evidence of any of that.
Right.
When you turn over 11,000 documents, I mean, for example, because the plaintiffs requested documents by numbers that they gathered from other cases, they sometimes requested documents that didn't exist. And we would point that out.
Your position, though, is that even if all that's true, no matter how egregious the discovery abuse, it cannot result in waiver of this privilege.
It can result in much more severe penalties. It
but
can result,
but
not waiver of the privilege. That is, for the court to undertake, not as a promulgated rule through the Rules Committee, not as a new rule, but as an ad hoc measure in a particular case, the sculpting of a new remedy when the existing rules and statutes already provide a panoply of remedies would raise serious separation of powers problems under the Constitution of Texas, and would, I think, be an unwise exercise of power in any event. But it's all quite hypothetical, because I believe there was no abuse, and I also don't think it would be wise for this court, in vindicating what are rather clear principles of right here, in effect to wait until another court says that the sanctions were impermissible, because that really is somewhat circular. That is,
if we determined that the trial court and the master were correct, and there had been unclean hands, that would provide a basis for our denying mandamus.
Well, I don't think there's authority for that. I'm
well,
simply
authority
unprepared.
In this court for that.
Well, unclean hands is one of those sort of magic wands that I suppose one can wave over things and say, because what you seek is equitable, and because you have conducted yourself inequitably, we will deny you relief. But I think that the authority for that proposition, if I might, Justice Doggett, comes from contexts in which the right being asserted by the plaintiff is not nearly as simple and dramatic. That is, here it is equitable only in a technical sense. It's true that the writ of mandamus is an equitable writ, but when the alleged abuse of discretion, as here, consists not in simply a form of misconduct, you know, too quick a hearing, no real hearing, but consists in making up rules out of whole cloth, in finding exceptions that the rules do not provide, the work product doctrine, and in violating state and federal constitutional rights by saying that the mere interposition of a defense is waiver, seems to me you'd have to have hands dripping, I don't know what, but unclean hands would not suffice, it seems to me, to withhold a writ of mandamus in that situation. And I do stress in that connection that the plaintiffs have never suggested, apart from this very conclusory reference to unclean hands, have never suggested that an appeal would be a sufficient remedy here. That is, if we were required to turn over these documents, and if the writ of mandamus were withheld, and then later on it was said that because we could not prove that the documents, by virtue of exposing our strategy, had effectively made it impossible for us to fairly battle it out in court, that we then would suffer an adverse verdict, and in the meantime these documents would have floated around the country as they are shared among plaintiff's lawyers, it seems to me that the result of withholding the equitable remedy of mandamus would not simply be relegating us to an adequate legal remedy, but leaving us without any remedy at all. And it seems to me that it is an important dimension of the rule of law, that there ought not to be rights without remedies. There ought not to be a situation in which we are told that by virtue of invoking our state and federal constitutional rights to deny the plaintiff's allegations, and by doing it vigorously, and by not turning over non-existent documents, and by repackaging things in 16 boxes instead of 15, that we are in a kind of nether world, a limbo of no remedy for our state and federal rights.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Ballard, and arguments as a response.
May it please the court, my name is Bob Ballard, Robert Ballard. I appear to defend the order of Judge Caldwell. I'd like to make three basic points. First, the record that Owens Corning brings before the court is, at best, tainted. There's no chain of custody tracing the documents that are now on deposit with the court to those that were examined by Judge Caldwell and the master.
How could there be?
Sir?
How could there be?
The question is, how could there have been, Your Honor? Owens Corning was urged again and again to leave those documents, to file a copy of the documents with the court. I believe the master has sent a communication, which is unusual, I believe, but the master has sent a communication pointing out the problem with Owens Corning absolutely refusing to leave the documents with them, where they would be in custody with the trial court.
What of the excerpt from the May 7th hearing that Mr. Tribe referred to?
Your Honor, that did occur at that hearing. If it's one I'm thinking about, I asked the master to take custody of the documents. Relying upon the reputation of the lawyers that appeared before her, she allowed them to take them with them. After that, I believe on July 13th, there was another hearing. August 28th, September 29th, and I apologize, I can't give you the specific dates, but I know that time and again, there was a request from the court to leave those documents with the court, to at least file a complete set with the court. The court had retained, some documents, but it needed a complete set. And Owens Corning could have done that. Mr. Manning, of being in Manning, assured Master Johnson on December 5 that that would be done. It hasn't been done. And so the chain of custody that traces those documents to this court is based upon falsehoods that have been uttered in this court by the lawyers who had custody, as has been pointed out.
Do we know that the documents that we have are not the documents that were presented to the master?
Your Honor, I don't know. I don't know that they are. I don't know that they aren't. That's the problem.
Well, sir, isn't it unfair to say that saying that we have the documents is a falsehood? In fact, we actually don't know one way or the other.
Your Honor, the falsehood that I referred to is the representation by counsel for Owens Corning that they had been instructed to retain the documents. That was a falsehood.
Well, he only read from the May 7th hearing.
I'm sorry?
He read from the May 7th hearing.
Yes, sir. And there is before the court a January 21, 1991 letter from Master Johnson. There is a letter before the court on January 29, 1991, referring to the problems concerning the custody of the documents. I would suggest to the court that there is a defect so huge in the chain of custody of these documents that to request this court to independently review them would be improper and would be grounds for denying the writ of mandamus because there's no showing that that Judge Caldwell abused his discretion.
Should we appoint a master to determine if the documents we have are the same ones that were presented to the master?
I suggest not, Your Honor, because the master...
Just assume that they're not?
Your Honor, until they are proven by the one who has the burden of proof, I presume that the court should not just automatically take the word that these are what they purport to be.
Is there any authority for that?
That's battered on horseback, Your Honor. The second point, but to continue, Your Honor, in essence, this court shouldn't appoint a new master because of the questionability of the documents. In effect, Owens Corning, dissatisfied with the trial court's review of the documents, said, Supreme Court, you review them. I think we could open up a lot of litigation in the Supreme Court reviewing documents in the first instance. I think it would be a bad precedent. There has been no showing that Judge Caldwell abused his discretion. I think the clear record is that he followed existing established law. He exercised his discretion after giving Owens Corning every chance, and they persisted in abusing his officers.
What is the record concerning what Judge Caldwell did as opposed to what his master did?
It goes back, Your Honor, if I may, to, I think, one of our exhibits. Beginning in April of 1990, before the in-camera examination, Judge Caldwell warned Owens Corning on April 9, April 17, and again on May 30 about their dilatory tactics and their discovery abuses. He had seen documents at that point and apparently recognized the fact that he didn't have time to go through these, so he appoints a master to go through them. I think the record is clear that the master repeatedly conferred with Judge Caldwell. She would take him documents for his personal review. The record shows that he had in-court hearings. He was on top of the situation. Now, whether he looked at each document or not, I don't know. I can't say. I can't tell you what's in the documents because we haven't seen them. All we've got is the record. But the record suggests the Judge Caldwell did review the documents, he did stay up to date on them, and that based on that he entered his order.
Counsel, how can we determine whether Judge Caldwell abused his discretion without reviewing the documents?
That's precisely the point, Your Honor. It's not my burden of proof. Owens Corning cannot prove that he abused his discretion.
Your comments were just a moment ago that you did not think it would be appropriate for this court to review the records produced for an in-camera inspection by the special master.
Yes, sir, for a number of reasons.
Caldwell. How can we determine whether there was or was not an abuse of discretion without conducting an in-camera inspection of our own?
That's precisely the point, Your Honor, that I was trying to make, is that the court, in reviewing the record to determine an abuse of discretion, must review the record that comes up from the trial court. It must look at what the trial court looked at. My suggestion is that there is such a question about the nature of the documents that this court simply cannot do it.
That you think it would be useless to conduct an in-camera inspection of the records that have been produced?
Question, Your Honor, is, as we pointed out in our brief, Owens Corning has renumbered documents in a court in Mississippi and represented that documents examined in this case did not exist there. Same numbers. That raises a question in my mind. Maybe unreasonable, but when a litigant has the temerity or whatever to misrepresent to a court in support of its record, I suggest there's question. Now the court, if it elects to, can examine these. But my suggestion is, how will this master know that these are the same documents that Judge Caldwell looked at?
You can always raise that allegation.
Sorry?
You can always raise that allegation. And if all you have to do to establish it is to raise it, that does not leave much protection by mandamus.
Well, Your Honor, mandamus is a limited remedy, as I understand. The court wants to determine if the trial court abused its discretion. and the burden's on the one who comes forward, and I believe the court has described it as a heavy burden. I simply suggest that Owens Corning has not discharged his burden to bring this court a proper record.
Counsel, your brief states that wood product is not excluded unless prepared in anticipation of trial. You cite Axelson, which is a 1990 Supreme Court case, but that's not a wood product case, and I couldn't understand how it supported your position.
Your Honor, I believe the statement was that the Axelson, as I recall, dealt with both attorney-client and work product. I could be mistaken. I know the Scott case and the Axelson case came out at or about the same time. I'm confused. I can't answer your question.
What is your position on that issue? About whether the work product is protected only with respect to the litigation it's prepared for?
Your Honor, I believe that the work product is protected in connection with the cases or the litigation and for which it was prepared.
How about attorney-client?
Attorney-client, Your Honor, can be perpetual. It can transcend both this case and the other cases.
So the work product, you must admit that's different than the federal rule.
Yes.
The Supreme Court has established.
Yes, sir.
What about either the language or the history of our work product doctrine would support a distinction between the Texas approach and the federal approach, if it exists?
Your Honor, that's a global question. I don't think that I have the education or the time to fully explain it. I would suggest this, that the federal
court... Support to the present rule, then. Are any cases from this court that would support such a distinction?
I'm sorry, would you state again, sir?
Well, if you can't point to the history and tradition, then how can you point to anything in the language of our rule, that as the rule has been codified, or anything in state Supreme Court or decisions that would justify our drawing such a distinction?
Yes, sir. There is an exception in the rule of privilege, which is 503D, that there is no privilege to perpetrate a crime or a fraud. I suggest that a litigant who intentionally abuses the judicial system is perpetrating a fraud in the court.
Well, but that's different than the question of work product. If the extent of the work product protection in the absence of any type of fraud or any failure of proof.
Yes, sir. I believe
your answer to the previous question was is that work product did not extend from one lawsuit to another.
Yes, sir.
And what can you cite to us to support making such a distinction between the Texas work product rule and the federal work product rule?
The cases, Your Honor, I understood. I'm sorry, I'm catching me a little bit off balance, and I apologize. I had read the Axelson and Scott cases together. As I understood, if I'm misstating, I apologize, was that the information sought was not prepared in connection with litigation in which it was requested, which I understood to be the distinction between work product.
I thought that was an expert's report. I don't have the case in front of me.
I think that's where they de-designated an expert and settled and then claimed privilege over it. Justice Gonzalez wrote the opinion and is much more familiar with it. I apologize that I'm vague on it, John.
In any event, those are the only two cases you have.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, since we agree the attorney-client privilege has perpetual protection, and under 166B3, it states that the attorney-client privilege rule shall govern the work product privilege.
Yes, sir.
Why doesn't the work product privilege have perpetual protection also?
Because the work product, 166B3, incorporates, well, I keep getting off on the crime or fraud exception. It includes all of the attorney-client privilege. The 166B3 includes all the privileges. Now, the question is, privilege is a matter for the court to determine and not for the litigants. So I suggest that it's whatever.
When you say that Judge Caldwell reviewed the records, do you mean personally or through his master?
Both. And again, I want to emphasize, John, I can't tell you how many individual documents he examined. But the record, again, the record shows that Master Johnson would go to him with documents, show him these. Now, which ones there were, I don't know. The record doesn't say.
You said you had three main points. You've expressly mentioned one, and I gather some of our recent questions are a second.
Yes, sir. The second point is that privilege is for the courts to determine, not the litigants.
And the third point,
Your Honor, is that this is, I believe, a prime case for application or an invocation of the obstruction of the clean hands doctrine. Even before the order of discovery was entered, Owens Corning was engaged in defending itself for sanctions for obstruction of justice. And that has come to pass. There is a specific finding that Owens Corning has obstructed justice in these cases, has abused the courts and the plaintiffs.
The court has plenty of authority under Rule 215 to impose whatever sanctions it deems appropriate given discovery of abuse. What authority do you have that a privilege is waived or could be deemed waived by the court for discovery of abuse? That's not listed in Rule 215.
That's correct, Your Honor. I suggest that the court has greater authority than that. It's not that the court's authority is not limited to Rule 215. I suggest that it has the inherent power to punish for contempt, for direct and indirect contempt. For direct contempt, that is, which occurs within the view of the court, the court has the power to do what is necessary to make it right.
That power is limited to a $500 fine and 6 months in prison.
I think that.
Are you suggesting it broader that for contempt you could punish them however?
Your Honor, I would suggest the court has the power to do what is necessary to get the litigant to comply with the court ruling. Yes, sir.
Should we await the resolution of the sanctions mandamus case before we determine this, if unclean hands is the major reason to deny relief here?
Your Honor, if the court is going to couch it in turn or base its opinion upon the unclean hands, I would suggest that the court could wait. I suggest that the record is sufficient at this point to support the court's decision. And the reason I suggest that is we've been trying to get these documents for going on 2 years. We still don't have them, and any further delay will further delay the trial.
Can you summarize then for us what you think is the strongest indication in this record that there has been an obstruction of justice under the unclean hands? That these hands are truly unclean, not just a little bit.
Yes, sir. The record suggests that Owens Corning, and bear in mind, Your Honor, that Judge Caldwell had before him more proceedings than what is brought forward with this record. He's seen individual actions on approximately 12 to 14 defendants. But I suggest that this record, if we limit it to just what is before this court, it shows that Owens Corning has selectively gone through his files and removed damaging documentation. And for that documentation, much of it is frivolous. And again, I must read through the master's report because I've not seen it. They've made frivolous claims of attorney-client privilege. They've misrepresented to the master. They've ignored the trial court after three distinct warnings about dilatory tactics. There have been falsehoods uttered in this court, which I can't even contemplate. And when you put it all together, you see a continuous course of conduct that is designed to obstruct justice.
What's the basis for that, Mr. Ballard, other than your statement from the podium?
Each of those?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I'm going from the master's report. I've brought forward exhibits.
You're referring to the master's report, then?
Not altogether. There's letters from Judge Caldwell to Owens Corning's lawyers saying you waived your privileges. Sanctions will be considered on April 9. There was an April 7. No, the April 9 was an order.
But there needs to be some basis for it.
Yes, sir.
Besides just a finding. where in the record can we find these abuses that you described?
Again, we have to go to the record, Your Honor.
The record before us?
Before you, yes, sir.
And where? And
what we have?
The master's reports? Is
that the master's report, the communications from Judge Caldwell to the defendant, both in court and through personal correspondence. There has been brought forward in the record that Owens Corning has a finding of obstruction of justice against them. I believe that was brought forward and injected into the case by them. And again, the open court hearings that we've had, and again, they are a portion of the record. Does that answer the court's question?
Not entirely. What I'm interested in more is not the master's finding or the trial court's finding, but where in the record, in the evidence adduced at some point in the process, can we find the abuses of which you speak?
I forgot the letter of January 21 and January 29, 1991, from Master Johnston to the court at the request. I can't tell the court where in the record the misconduct occurred, generally because it was in camera. When Owens Corning would expand upon his claims of privilege by ex parte and the master during the in-camera proceeding, the plaintiffs were excluded.
The master allowed them.
Sorry?
The master allowed them.
May or may not, John. I have not seen the record.
Well, did they force it on the master?
That I can't say. I don't have the record.
Say you can't prove their allegations of unclean hands because the records inspection was done in camera?
No, sir.
That's not what you're saying?
That's only a part of it. We have the master's report. That's all I have, together with the hearings before Judge Caldwell and his communications. We had an open hearing on the sanctions that began October 10. At which time the lawyers admitted that they had never seen the documents for which they claimed privilege, and that they claimed privilege for blank pieces of paper as vigorously as they did for published case reports, medical articles, etc.
And as vigorously as you requested?
As vigorously as I requested, Your Honor?
I mean, you all requested blank pieces and they claimed they were privileged.
No, sir. We selected pages from an index that was prepared by Owens Corning and furnished to us. For example, there was an index that suggested a 1973 document. At first it was claimed to be privileged. The privilege was withdrawn. It was produced to us. There was a document produced bearing the same number, but what it was a 1951 annual statement of Owens Corning. It did not match the index.
Any other questions?
You know,
Counsel, you had said there were false statements made in this court also?
Yes, sir.
What are the false statements that were made in this court?
Your Honor, the statement was that Owens Corning had been instructed to retain the documents. There was a statement made that Judge Caldwell simply rubber-stamped the documents and never reviewed them. Those are pointed out in the letters of January 21 and January 29. And again, that's in the record, Your Honor.
Counsel, if everybody else is through, I'm just going to get on a soapbox for about 30 seconds. Don't these two mandamuses that are going simultaneously in different courts and this litigation show the need for some type of legislative solution to a crisis of this magnitude? Essentially, these are the same documents that a federal court in that a state court in Iowa and a federal court in Mississippi
That's
and
correct.
Know about. No telling how many other courts have reviewed and have had the same problems we're having.
I agree, Your Honor. It is a major problem. It's a major problem because the dockets are congested trying hypothetical fact situations. For instance, Dean Tribe suggested that they have the right to deny. And to put that into context, let me give a totally different factual situation. Who run the red light? Basic automobile court case. Is the defendant in that situation entitled to deny that he ran the red light when there's 15,000 witnesses that said he did, and that he told his insurance company that he did, and that he's doing this to try to win his case in court? Answer is no. And that's the point here. Owens Corning knew by 1942 not only that asbestos was dangerous, but that his products were dangerous. It's asbestos-containing products.
You mean if he was sued, he could not deny that in court? Is that?
He can raise a general denial, Your Honor, and put the plaintiff to his burden of proof. Yes, sir. But then to come forward, suppose he admits to everybody in hearing that, yes, I ran the red light. I was in a hurry. No question. Is he then able to come in and produce expert witnesses, documentary evidence that he didn't run the red light? I think to ask the question is answered. But back to Justice Phillips' question. Either, if there is a change to be made, the relief should come through the common law, changing the burden of proof in of manufacturing defect cases, design defect cases, and marketing defect cases. Either we have products liability or we do not. Either the product harmed the people or it does not. Laws? No, John, I don't think so. I would disagree that we need a national law for asbestos cases.
But doesn't the very fact, just the record that we were asked to review to decide this one mandamus show that a limited pot of money is largely being distributed among attorneys, claims adjusters, and expert witnesses, and not among those people who
I don't think that's really
sustain losses?
I don't think that's the justification for changing the law of Texas, Your Honor. Whether there is or is not a sufficient pot is not justification for changing the right, the obligation of a litigant, and particularly a lawyer, to exercise candor with the court.
Well, as I said, it was an irrelevant question, but it just, I was pained looking through this record, and
yes,
it's being symptomatic of a larger national problem.
I think the court has put its finger on the point that this record and the court's comment explains the obstruction of justice. We're spending all of our time pouring through documents and wrestling with trying to change the law.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Mr. Prime presents the argument that you later.
May it please the court, there is something genuinely Kafkaesque for me about this. When the court asks, how do we know these aren't the documents? I mean, what makes you think they aren't? There are, after all, affidavits from Ms. Halstead White and Mr. Manning, dated February 27, who had personal custody, saying these are the documents. They say, well, I guess we don't know. It's just Ballard on horseback. Well, that's all very nice, but the headless horseman in this case carries quite a size, not just a $500 fine. This is an enormous penalty that's supposed to be imposed on what? On the basis, we are told, of an in-camera transcript where there was proof of misconduct, so there are unclean hands. You will recall that one of our central arguments is that it is a fundamental denial of due process to impose adverse conclusions on OCF on the basis of an in-camera transcript that they were denied the right to see. And there's been no answer to that. They were told they could see it if they waived the privilege. That seems to be the recurring message here. You can deny that you are bad guys if you give up your rights. Ever since the 1920s, the United States Supreme Court said that that was an unconstitutional condition. And as Justice Heck pointed out, there's nothing to stop people from asserting that there has been tampering of documents. I mean, even if, let us suppose, even if what they want were to occur and the judge himself were to look over these 11,000 documents, they admit that they don't have any idea whether they were ever personally reviewed by the judge. I don't know that there was time to read 11,000 documents, even with the best speed reading course in the world, in those 2 days between our objections and his ruling. So what is it all about? It seems to me that we have simply a smokescreen, a suggestion that because there was some unspecified misconduct on the basis of a record that we haven't really been allowed to see, on the basis of accusations that are conclusory, that we've done something wrong. When this court asks Mr. Ballard, why exactly Do you deny the statement, and I did read it from May 7th, that it was permissible for them to keep the documents? Well, they say that the special master several times repeated her allegation that there had been a court order to the contrary. We pointed out in fairly careful submissions to this court that that court order was a figment of her imagination. There was no such court order. They've not denied that. It was, I think, Lewis Carroll and not Franz Kafka who's quoted in the Taming of the Snark, whatever I repeat three times is true. I think the special master could say it 30 times and it wouldn't make it true that there had been a court order that we didn't comply with. All of that is sheer obfuscation. But when it comes to the merits of this case, you notice how little there is for the other side to say. When they are pressed on what authority they have by the Chief Justice in either the text or the history of Rule 166B3A to support such a radical departure from Hickman v. Taylor, the 1947 decision, which is the granddaddy of all this doctrine, state and federal law, they admit there is none. Both the Texas and federal work product doctrines tracing to Hickman are subject to the interpretation that Justice Brennan, I think, powerfully gave in Grolier, and that is that those doctrines do not simply expire with time. And as this court pointed out, since the very text of the work product protection refers to the exceptions being those in the attorney-client privilege, which they concede to be perpetual, I think they have effectively given up most of their case by essentially conceding, after all the shuffling is done, that the reasons given by the court below for rejecting privilege don't hold water, regardless of what's in those 16 boxes. And in any event, I think it was Justice Hecht's dissent in Lofton v. Martin that one could paraphrase, no inspection is necessary for this court to determine whether the district court's ruling was too broad. Fact is, it was unbearably broad. It's true in that case that Justice Mosley and Justice Hightower dissented, but didn't dissent. They were in the majority with Justice Spears. I think I'm counting wrong. The fact is that in Lofton, the ground for the majority was that the order in part requested documents that were unprivileged. Here, if you just read the order of the 18th, the reasons that it gives amount to a flat repudiation of Texas and federal principles about work product doctrine and about what it takes to get offensive waiver. And even if they were right that there was some kind of misconduct, and the very claims of misconduct evaporate, it seems to me, as we speak, they recede into the corners of the room into some in-camera proceedings transcript we are not allowed to get. As Justice Hecht pointed out, $500 fine is what that would lead to. It seems to me that all that's left is for this court to render judgment itself. Why wait for another court which is waiting for you? And it was in the Barnes case, in which Justice Mosley wrote for the court,
counsel. Does anybody want to ask a question about any of these matters?
Barnes, could I just make one quick point? In Barnes, you reviewed the documents yourself, and I think you are capable of it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second call. The court will now take a brief recess.
Please rise.